Lampoon's Disaster. Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk with Christian Borle. We also talk about Beautiful, the Carole King musical, Disaster, Macbeth, Handle With Care, Holler If You Hear Me, Hee Haw, and the curious incidents of the dog in the nighttime. Please stay tuned. It was Jubilation T. Carn Pone, old toot your own horn pone, Jubilation T. Carn Pone, a man who knew no fear. When we almost had him, but the issue still was in doubt. Who suggested the retreat that turned it into a rout? Why, it was
Jubilation T. Carn Pone.
He wrecked old tattered and torn pone. Jubilation T. Carn Pone, he kept us hiding out.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, January 12, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critterland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
With us this morning, we have a special guest. We have Christian Borle, who is joining us on a Sunday morning. Christian, thank you so much for saying hello.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. Good morning. I'm a pacer. So as I'm talking, if you hear my footsteps, that's what it is. I can't be on the phone and not pace.
Uh-huh.
I have that same exact thing. My big challenge here is that I have a headset on with a cable, so I can't pace anymore. But it's good that you get your exercise in the morning as well.
That's right. Keep the energy flowing.
So, Christian, our listeners know you from, I guess, your 7 or 8 Broadway appearances in Footloose, Jesus Christ Superstar, Millie, Thirdly, Modern Millie, Amore, Spamalot, Mary Poppins, Legally Blonde, and Peter and the Starcatcher. So tell us, you know, has the musical theater thing always been in your blood?
Since about sophomore year of high school, I would say, is when I officially caught the bug. When I realized that I was in Pittsburgh, and a friend of mine dragged me to an audition for Oklahoma. I was 4'11 at the time, very small for my age. I had a little skate rat kind of hairdo, hair flopping in front of my face. And I didn't know to be scared of the whole thing, so I just kind of like hopped up on stage, and I don't remember what I sang. And I didn't have like a great voice or anything, but I had gusto, and I ended up getting Will Parker. It was the beginning of everything, and I loved it, of course, and that there was no turning back. Literally, I just kept going, and people kept letting me do it.
Wow. Now, of course, Will Parker is a dancing role as well. So did you have that natural ability, or did they audition you for dancing as well?
Well, we're talking about, you know, the high school equivalent of dancing.
Of course, yes.
A couple of bell kicks and an organ grinder, and you're all set, you know what I mean?
So you in the Pittsburgh area, and then what did you do after that? Did you end up in at CCM or Michigan or one of the great Midwestern schools for theater?
I ended up at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. I wanted to go to Northwestern. I wanted to get away and have like a real college experience, you know? And my girlfriend at the time actually said that one of the best acting schools in the whole world is right in your backyard. Why are you not even considering it? And that kind of changed my trajectory, and I love CMU. It gave me a great, great foundation to move to the city, and so I did.
It's a great network of people who came before and after you that have worked on Broadway.
Truly, truly. And I think there's something special in the water in Pittsburgh. There's so many great Pittsburghers out there, people who grew up in Pittsburgh and actually went to CMU. When I ended up doing Angels in America with Zach Quinto and Billy Porter, both native Pittsburghers, both CMU boys.
It's the merging of the three rivers there. That's usually the problem.
Yes, I think that's it.
Maybe it's something in the hills.
The Hills Are Alive?
Now that, that isn't a segue. I don't know what it is.
I didn't even intend that, but now that you mentioned it.
Did you,
well, that's right. Here, let's get into it.
That's right. You did that thing, didn't you?
It happens. Live, apparently.
I think a few people saw that. Yeah, a few people.
I think so.
That was exciting that so many people saw that, truly. That whole experience was a thrill from top to bottom.
I'll bet.
How long was that rehearsal process for you?
All told, I think it was 2 months. We had about 5 weeks in the room, and then we shifted to the studios out there in Long Island and tried to figure it out there. Yeah, it was fantastic and bizarre.
We should formally say that we're talking about The Sound of Music Live on NBC. That was a month or two ago.
Yeah.
That we're talking about, so that our listeners are like, what are they talking about?
What are they talking about? I have to say, Christian, I was very upset to see the Nazis drag Max off at the end.
Yeah.
So invested were you in his arc?
Yes. Thanks to you, yes.
Then my work here is done.
Have you been recognized more on the street since that airing?
Actually, no, and, okay. And that's okay. I kind of chalked that up to the severe character work that I was doing. they said mustache and glasses and slick hair, and I said, yes, I'll cut the limp, but I want everything else.
They didn't have enough money in the budget for the limp.
Right. It comes at a cost.
So,
all right, now Pittsburgh is also famous for the Civic Light Opera. Were you taken to that as a kid? Did you ever go? Was this in your purview at all?
I was. Actually, once my parents were really great and very, very supportive of this whole crazy endeavor. My dad was a doctor, and I remember having a conversation with him one day. He was disappointed that I wasn't following in his footsteps, and he sweetly said, absolutely not. So once they realized that I had the bug, we got a subscription and we saw some great shows coming through CLO, and I couldn't get arrested at CLO.
Uh-huh.
They would not have me.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure about someday to go back.
I was just going to say, you should say, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, I'd love to. I really would.
Now, in terms of
finally, the world will get to see my Music Man.
We know they said Jeff Goldblum's, but that's another story. All right.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
So, Little Me, was this a show that you ever encountered in any way, shape, or form? It's not that famous a show.
I saw the Martin Short revival. A college buddy of mine was in the ensemble. And do you remember what theater that was at? It was in
yes.
Times Square at a theater
yes.
that's no longer there. Am I remembering that right?
The Criterion Center.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. How bizarre. And I've always been a huge, huge Martin Short fan. Actually, in high school, I was the one of the founders and presidents of the Ed Grimley Club at school.
Ah.
We didn't really get much accomplished. But I loved him, and I thought he was magnificent. And so as I'm kind of like prepping for this thing, I'm trying in some ways to put him out of my brain and come up with something original. But I still have a couple of his choices just buried deep down that I'm going to honor.
All right, now the question becomes, while you're watching Little Me, did you say to yourself, hey, that's a great part, I'd love to do that someday?
Sure, in my cocky little way, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
It actually was at a time before I had, I think, any confidence whatsoever. So there was a great, I think at the time I was just so excited to see my friend and his kind of Broadway debut that the last mm-hmm. thing I was thinking of was like one day I'd tackle that guy over there, the main guy. So. But it's thrilling. It's been this faraway thing for a while, and now I can't believe that rehearsals are 2 weeks away.
All right. Now, of course, Little Me, in the 80s, they split up the roles between James Coco and Victor Garber. You're playing all seven, aren't you?
It's going to be six. I think because of encores and their kind of their quest to make it as lean and mean as possible, they cut the last part, the child junior.
Oh,
Noble Junior.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be six, but yeah, I'm going to tackle six of them.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's interesting.
Maybe now I can work that limp in.
I'm sure. Yeah. That 82 one, I saw, and it's interesting. I interviewed Victor Garber recently, and he said the only reason they split it up was because that James Coco didn't feel he could handle all of them at that point. I think he was already somewhat ill at that point. So that's an interesting, and what's also interesting is I saw the transfer of that production in London, and they went back to it being one person who I was unfamiliar with. I don't know if you guys know him. His name is Russ Abbott.
I saw that production as well.
Oh yeah. And he was actually hilarious. I mean, it was again, one of those things where, you know, I mean, some of the roles he didn't remotely look like that person would look like, for example, Noble Eggleston. I mean, you had this 55-year-old guy, you know, but that just made it funnier.
Yeah.
And it was,
that's part of the gag. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So it was really quite something.
I think Martin Short added another part. He wanted to play one of the two vaudeville brothers, the Buschbaum brothers.
That's right. That's right.
And I just, how would he have even a time to get a drink of water? That's an overachiever right there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, when Peter and the Starcatcher first started, there you are down at New York Theater Workshop. Did you have a dream that it was going to turn out to be as significant for you as it did?
None of us saw that coming. I think, you know, when we started off in La Jolla, even at the Page to Stage program, it was this fantastic whirlwind, and we all fell in love with each other. We never expected to wind up downtown in New York. And so when that happened, we were obviously all over the moon. And that it just kept kind of luckily happening. I didn't in my wildest dreams envision it. And actually, there really was a significant chunk of time where, because of the, you know, the boon that was Smash that I enjoyed so much, it looked like I wasn't going to be able to do it on Broadway. And it was only when they got the Brooks Atkinson Theater that the kind of the calendar shifted, and then it suddenly magically fit in. But yeah, I was heartbroken for a couple of months there. They were going to go on and do it without me.
That's right. I remember that.
Yes, I do too. In fact, I remember talking to you about that. We were waiting at a plane in Teterboro. We had just come back from the Junior Theater Festival in Atlanta, where there was a big Smash kickoff. Do you remember this a couple of years ago? We were in Atlanta.
I do. I was so hoping you would work in the private jet store.
flying private. That's just the new thing with Christian Borough, you know.
If you can pick one up, I highly recommend it.
If you do have the means, yes.
Yes,
but anyway, yes, I do remember at that point, yes, you weren't doing it on Broadway. Yes, that came back to me now that you mentioned it. Yeah, so
that
chatting
was a lucky turn of events, the whole thing.
Chatting over champagne and caviar on the private plane. Oh, I can't work in my Broadway show with my new television show. And
what I mainly remember about that day is how dreadfully overcast it was.
Did you fire anybody, Christian?
No, I certainly threw a tantrum. These trade tables are slightly off kilter. I took out my level, but anyway, blah, blah, blah. But it all happened, and actually that BMI thing was so beautiful watching those kids that, it took me back to sophomore year, actually.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I bet it did. Sure. That makes sense.
So, we skipped right over all the details of Little Me, which is coming up. It's the City Center's Encores production on February 5th to the 9th. And you mentioned you're going into rehearsal in 2 weeks.
Yes, sir. It's, you know, we're going to have about 10 days to throw this thing together.
Have you done any Encores before?
I did On the Town a few years ago, actually, with John Rando again. So I'm really excited to work with him again. He's so much fun. And, hands off when he needs to be, and then has amazing ideas when you need him.
It's quite a cast you have going there. Robert Crichton, David Garris,
yes!
Harriet Harris, Judy Kaye, Lee
Wilcoff. Stalin, Lee Wilcoff.
Yeah.
Have you already talked to Rachel York? Have you talked to her yet today?
No, we haven't talked to Rachel. Rachel she's doing like 17 shows this weekend or something like that.
I just saw her do Dames at Sea, in fact, at a Backers audition. So she has been busy.
We're going to catch up with her in a few weeks. But
I'm so excited. The woman has a sterling reputation. I have yet to work with her.
Oh.
And everyone that I talk to is just over the moon. So apparently she's made of magic or something.
Yes. And so you're going into rehearsal for that, and that'll be fun. What is going to come up for you after that? Do you have anything on the agenda or taking a nice break?
You know, like all actors, looking for work. But then I'm really, really excited. They're doing Sweeney Todd with the New York Philharmonic with Emma Thompson. Lonnie Price is directing that. Brent Terfel's playing Sweeney Todd. And Lonnie, who's been one of the sweetest people to me since I moved to New York City, grabbed me and asked me if I could possibly sing Pirelli.
Oh.
To which I said, I don't know. We'll find out. And I think I have it. So I'm really, really excited. Sweeney's been one of my favorites for a very long time, so I kind of can't believe that's happening.
That's some high note there, Pirelli sings.
Have you used that kind of head voice before, ever?
I glanced it with Prince Herbert in Spamalot.
Okay.
But nothing quite like this. So I'm studying. I'm back to studying, a student again. And it's been fascinating to see what the voice can do at this point.
Who's your voice teacher?
Joan Lehter. Fabulous Joan Lehter.
Oh, great. Wow. It's always interesting to talk with people who are successful working actors at the top of their game that continue to study. And we have a lot of students that listen to our show here, and we just encourage them to this process never stops.
It doesn't ever stop.
And it's great.
And, you know, to those people, I would say over the course of the relatively short amount of time that I've been doing this thing, I would say that the only two like necessary things, aside from just kind of being blessed with some kind of talent, is to just be as prepared as you possibly can and be the most prepared person in the room and don't be a jerk. Those are the keys to success as I see them.
That's true. We've heard about a lot of, we've talked over the years here on this show about people who are very talented that don't work and people who are not so talented that work all the time because they're great to work with.
That's right. They're the people that you want to be around.
So absolutely. So Christian, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning. I really appreciate you taking the time to get up and talk with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for letting me. Great to talk to you guys.
All right. Okay. Take care. Have a good one.
Hi.
Bye-bye. So Peter, any more private flights on jets going around the world seeing musical theater? Going to happen soon?
Friday, in fact.
Okay. I'll keep rubbing it in, you know? You get to go to all the good backers auditions and fly in private planes.
All right.
And, you know, I'm really thinking, Michael, have you ever seen Cameron McIntosh in the same room as Peter Felicia? I don't know. Maybe they're the same.
Michael's still with us?
I'm here yet.
Yes, silence. Silence is the way to answer that.
Actually, I've only seen Cameron McIntosh once at the bar at Angus McIndoe.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, that's the only time I saw him live that I know of.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, so let's move forward with our reviews. Peter got a chance to see Beautiful, the Carole King musical, and which is opening tonight. So, Peter, what did you think about it?
I liked it quite a bit. It's funny because these biographical shows that involve trying to get to the top and romance, there's been a million of them going back to Funny Girl and way beyond that. So this is an example of Taint What You Do Is the Way That You Do It. And it's amazing how well that Doug McGrath makes us care about Carole King. And here she is getting married at a young age because she has to, as we used to say in the old days, because she's pregnant. And after success comes, her husband isn't particularly interested in staying married. And yet it's handled very well. It's not like he dumps her unceremoniously. Mm-hmm. He is very apologetic about it and says, I still love you, but, you know, we got married so young. And I'm telling you, they make it seem as if this is the first time it has ever happened in the history of the world. And that's what a good writer could do. He can make you feel that this is a unique situation. So I thought it was very, very skillful in the writing, and I like that quite a bit. Again, I won't be surprised if people don't feel this way because they'll just concentrate on the plot. And again, as I say, the plot is not revolutionary by any stretch of any imagination. But If you really look at the way it's detailed, and by the way, the book has a lot of wonderfully funny lines, too. He's really come through there. I mean, this is the co-author of the movie Bullets Over Broadway, which is one of my favorite movies. So I'm not surprised that it turned out to be as witty as it is. But nevertheless, it's nice to see it working so well. Very, very slickly directed and wonderfully staged by Mark Bruni. There isn't much choreography, but Josh Prince does the job well. What I've been hearing all through town is about Jesse Mueller, who scored so solidly with Clear Day a few years ago, playing Carole King. Yes, she's everything that people said she was, playing vulnerability very, very well. However, I was so impressed by the people I hadn't heard about, especially Anika Larsson as Cynthia Weil. Those from a certain generation know the name Cynthia Weil, along with Barry Mann. They were very big songwriters as well. But Anika Larsson gives the type of performance I like best. It doesn't seem like acting at all. So so I was tremendously impressed by her. We have another Larsson in the cast, Liz, who plays Carole King's mother. It's not a big part, but she does it awfully well. And a lot of parents, you know, it's funny, Christian Bull was talking about the fact that his father was a doctor, and of course, you might not expect a doctor to be thrilled that his son wants to go into show business. Liz Larsson is a different type of parent. She's discouraging all the way, and of course, once the success happens, she can't wait to take credit for it. And parents out there, if you have a kid who wants this, go with him, please, because if you don't, they're going to hate you anyway. So, and that comes up in here quite a bit, and very skillfully as well. Jeb Brown is Don Kirshner. I have to admit, you know, I was thinking, somehow I was thinking of Class Act when this was happening. I remember when my girlfriend and I went to Class Act, which has Lehman Engel in the show, actually running the BMI workshop. I don't know if people know this, but my girlfriend and I actually met in the BMI workshop. So we were both students in it. And I remember as Lehman Engel in Class Act is teaching everybody about a charm song, and he's so avuncular, and he's almost like Harold Till in 76 Trombones in that number. And Linda turned to me and said, "How come everybody's scared to death?" Because he was really a very imposing and a guy who could really scare you to death, indeed, when you got up there to do your song. And, you know, here's Don Kirshner being played as lovable beyond belief. And maybe that's it, beyond belief. I don't know. Maybe he really was a pussycat in real life. But this guy is really quite nice to everybody who comes his way. You walk into his office and you're nobody, and he treats you like you're a somebody. And I hope this is what Don Kirshner was really like. You know, I'd like to think that there were people like this in the entertainment world. Jake Epstein plays Jerry Goffin, who is the man that Carole King marries and turns out to be a collaborator in another sense, too. And that becomes a problem as well. If you break up the marriage, do you break up the collaboration? I know I'm not making it sound very interesting, but I'm telling you, Doug McGrath does. I predict that this is going to do very, very well, and I wish this show tremendously well. I haven't talked about the music at all, but hearing all these Carole King songs in a row, even the early ones, you find out she really has that wonderful, unexpected way of going with a melody that you expect it to go one way, and suddenly she does something very, very different. She knows how to write blue notes and wrong notes. Mm. And wrong notes is a compliment, by the way, meaning the type of note you don't expect is coming next. So I like Beautiful quite a bit, and I think it's going to be with us quite some time. I don't know if it's going to be I was at a party last night when somebody said, "It's Jersey Boys for girls." I see that point. I do. By the way, it was a woman who said that. She used the term girls, by the way. I see that point. I do, you know, and I don't know if it'll be that successful. That's a lot to ask. But nevertheless, I think it's going to please a lot of people, especially because Carole King has so many fans. When Linda, when I met Linda yesterday at the theater, she said to me, "My God, I can't tell you how many people have been coming up to me and saying, do you have an extra ticket? Look at that cancellation line over there." And I thought, well, this makes sense because that Tapestry album was one of the greatest sellers of all time. So therefore, there must be fans left over from that album who want to see the Carole King story. So maybe it will do as well as Jersey Boys, and that's just fine with me.
Well, I'm delighted to hear about the book, especially, Peter, because I think that the book has been the downfall of several of these bio musicals. And I think that's one major reason why it was not the downfall of Jersey Boys, because that has a very good book also. One cannot underestimate the importance of the book, even in a show like that. Motown would be an example to me of a show that does not have a good book, and the show suffered greatly because of it.
Sure,
so that's
maybe great. It's you. Maybe it's you too. I mean, yeah,
and the other one. Million Dollar Quartet. Yeah,
sure. You know, the thing is here, Jersey Boys was extraordinarily lucky. I'm not coming down on the talents of Rick Elise or his collaborator, but nevertheless. It was extraordinarily lucky that the group they were talking about was the Four Seasons, because that gave them their structure of summer, fall, winter, spring. You know, if they were the Four Lads, that wouldn't have occurred to them.
Right.
You know, and I mean, they were very lucky there. Again, they knew what to do with it once they had it. And the other wonderful thing about Jersey Boys is by showing us early on that they're breaking into a church, that one of them got arrested and had to go to prison, you got the impression they were telling us the truth.
Right.
They may not have. They may have glossed over many terrible things they did, for all we know. But nevertheless, at least they showed you they were willing to show dark sides. And as a result, you became confident that you were hearing a true story. So
now
that was very smart, too.
Here's a really interesting point. Peter, you mentioned that Cynthia Weil is a character in Beautiful. Who plays her, by the way?
Anika Lawson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what the connection is, but on this Monday, January 13th, there's going to be a party in celebration of the original cast recording of Murder for Two, that wonderful off-Broadway show.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what the connection is, but two of the guests are Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil.
Maybe they're just in town and want to get some.
Yeah, I guess. But is Barry Mann also a character in?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't mention him. Jared Spector plays him and does very well. He also is very well characterized as a hypochondriac. And it's very nice that this is not a situation where it's mentioned early in the show and then never brought up again. They do a nice job of coming back to it, and just enough. Not enough where you say, oh, God, they're milking the joke, so will they ever shut up about it? No, they really judiciously use that, so that's very nice too. So yes, he's very good as well. So yes, he is a character. So I guess they're just in town for the opening. You know?
Well, isn't that great that the actual people? I know they've been around. I know they did a show at Feinstein's that I did not see, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. But I'm looking forward to hopefully meeting them. This is fun for me. I tend to wallow in nostalgia at various moments. When I have a lot of free time. And I was listening to some Partridge Family albums recently. And they, you know, the songs really run the gamut from pretty terrible to excellent. And it invariably, anytime one that comes on and it's excellent, I look and who wrote it, and it's Cynthia Weil. So, you know, and of course that's, they're not remotely, I don't think any of the songs they wrote for the Partridge Family is what their fame rests on, but really it's some really good stuff. So I just thought that was interesting. And that's so great that they're going to be in town. They'll be at the opening tonight. You said Beautiful opens Sunday, right? Sunday.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, and there's been a lot of talk about the fact that Carole King has not been around to see this show, that that she still finds it too painful to deal with this part of her life. When
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. That's been pretty much said. There's even an article in Playbill that Robert Simonson wrote with her about the fact that, and I'm telling you, she is not going. So, that she actually went to an early reading and had to leave at intermission, saying, "Look, they're terrific. It's a good show. Don't misunderstand me. I just can't take this." So, so that's pretty interesting.
Hmm. So that's going to be opening tonight, and Michael and I are going to see it this week. So we'll report back next week on what we thought about it as well. One of the things that I noticed about Beautiful on Broadway is that they seem to have a lot of producers. I wonder if they had a problem raising this money for this this show. It seems like, you know, on paper, it seems like a home run, an easy show to do. But they're not, none of them are easy, are they, Peter?
No, of course not. It's not. You know, and who knows? Maybe everybody wanted a piece of it, you know, and so many people had claims to the material, something like that. That happens too. So who knows? But Paul Blake is the lead producer, and he certainly had a good deal of success out at St. Louis at the Muni, and also took a chance on doing White Christmas. A lot of people thought that was a bad idea, but certainly White Christmas has shown up a lot since he did it at his theater.
Yeah, White Christmas was no disaster, was it?
No, really. I mean, it gets productions all the time now. So good luck to it.
Speaking of disaster.
Yeah.
Peter, you got a chance to see Disaster the Musical this week. So tell us about that.
Well, it's funny because this is a jukebox musical as well. This uses songs from pretty much the same era, and that is the 70s. And Seth Rudetsky is one of the powers that be behind this project. And that's pretty impressive because not only did he write it, but he also shows up in it playing a lead role, and I admire when a writer takes a small role in a show as opposed to a large one, because he has enough to do, you know, making sure that the book is going to work out all right. He and his collaborator Jack Plotnick had to do that, but nevertheless, my point is, I think of Legs Diamond, where it wasn't enough for Peter Allen to be the star. It wasn't enough that he had to write the music, he had to write the lyrics. I mean, he overextended himself, and Seth has not overextended himself by doing co-writing the book and appearing in a small role. But nevertheless, this is subtitled A 70s Disaster Movie Musical. And I will admit that it is not a show for the ages. But nevertheless, these guys have done their homework. What they've done is they've taken all these songs from the 70s and they've really looked at every lyric to see if they can make something, if they can make hay out of a certain lyric. One example out of many, I'm going to give one away. Believe me, there are plenty left. But Mary Testa is freezing, and she needs somebody to bring her a jacket. And somebody brings her a jacket, but unfortunately it's made of down, and she sings, "Don't bring me down," because she's established she's allergic to it. There's a lot of stuff like that, and I mean, I applaud when the tail wags the dog in that way, that they look for meaning in the lyrics, because we all know that Seth is one of our most fabulous wits, and he certainly shows it here in his book. Terrific cast, no question about it, because there is people that we don't necessarily that aren't names, but are terrific performers. And I really, my hat really goes off to Jennifer Simard, who plays.
God, I love her.
Oh, I've never seen her better, and she's always magnificent. Okay, so here she plays a nun. who is somebody who just cannot stay away from those slot machines. I mean, she wants to, she tries, she knows it's wrong, but nevertheless, she just cannot stay away from them. So I'm telling you, such a deadpan performance. You know, she's just amazing in the way that she's one of these still waters run deep people that she's amazing in it. I just adored her beyond belief in this. So Drew Girasi, somebody else, Rob Sapp, these are good people, and they do astonishingly well. I did feel bad that I missed Mary Birdsong. She was out the night I went, because I'm a big Mary Birdsong fan. Yeah. In fact, we even gave her a Theater World Award a few years ago. And but her understudy, I can't say I remember her name. I apologize, but did a fine job. But it's one of these crazy shows. No question, it's a disaster. Yes, something terrible happens. It's not supposed to, of course. I won't give away that, what the disaster is, but nevertheless, it will seem familiar to many who lived through those disaster movies of the 70s, those Poseidons and earthquakes and all those things with sense around and what have you. So, but Seth has done a wonderful, wonderful job in sustaining it. And it's a tough thing to do, to sustain humor, you know, but nevertheless, I do think it would profit from not having an intermission. But everybody's working so hard, maybe they need the intermission more than we do. So, Full House, people had a hell of a time. So yes, I can recommend Disaster.
Jennifer Simard is another Forbidden Broadway alumnus. And yeah. I must say, I really think she's one of the most talented people on the face of the earth. I hope she achieves the success she really deserves someday. Just absolutely fantastic.
Well, then get thee to Disaster, because
I saw it. Yes, we had Seth and Jack on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I said, I swear to God, this is true. If I had $10 million, I would produce that show on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I think it could be a tremendous success. It was. The night I went, there was, as I've said, there was more laughter in that theater than any show I've seen since maybe The Producers. Mm-hmm. It was just, well, I will say, you know, for what it's worth, if you're unlucky enough to happen to see it on a night when most of the audience didn't live through that era and doesn't know those songs, I would imagine it's not going to be anywhere near as funny as if you yourself know those songs and live through that era, and you are with a group that is like you, because it does really depend a lot on that. Even though the jokes themselves are funny, obviously, if you know, to suddenly be confronted with this song that you grew up with, you know, coming out of nowhere in response to a pun like Peter explained, it's hysterically funny. So I hope, you know, I hope that everyone goes to see it, and I hope that you get an audience like Peter and I had, because it was really just incredible.
Well, also, I have to say that the 70s is off, and part of the point of this is that it's a cheesy era. And yet, you know, considering what we've been through with the way pop music is today, those songs don't sound so bad anymore. So we were lucky then, and we didn't even know it.
So I was going to say something. Oh, that's right. So on December 1st, we had Seth and Jack on. It was a week that Peter was off getting ready for his musical. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes so you can go back and listen to Seth and Jack's interview, which was very, very funny.
I'll bet.
Yeah. It was very hard to stop laughing during that interview. Mm-hmm. And
By the way, I don't know if you saw Peter, but Judy Gold, the wonderful comedian, is coming in soon to replace Mary Testa. So yeah. There's another example of like really, really great people that they're. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I'm sure, as Seth, I think, said, obviously they're not being paid very much at all. It's sure. Not even a full, by the way, it's not a full 8 performances a week. It's only 3 or 4, maybe.
Was that right?
Because there are other shows running in the same venue. So the fact that these people are doing this, you know, I think it speaks to, well, first of all, Seth's connections, but also the fact that everyone recognizes what an absolute hilarious piece this is. It's just, it's just really, really great.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's move forward. Peter saw the Lincoln Center production of Macbeth that is now closed. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, since it's closed, we don't have to really talk very much about it. But what I will say is I thought it was a terrific production. And if they only had had a Macbeth, it really would have been something. So I was sorry to say that I didn't find Ethan Hawke up to the task. So, but whoa, beautifully staged by Jack O'Brien. And oh, what lighting! Ah! Did I love the lighting? Tremendous job by a designer. I have to admit that I hadn't really noticed his name before. So I'm hoping that I've just been negligent and that he's had a terrific career. But if he hasn't, I dare say he will. His name is Jaffe Wiedemann. Wiedemann, and right from the get-go, you could tell that this was going to be magnificent lighting, and it's the best lighting I've seen this season. So I know this sounds like faint praise for a production when you're talking so much about the lighting, but again, beautifully staged by Jack O'Brien. So, but if you miss this Macbeth, and God knows Macbeth comes around a lot in our part of the world, you can live happily because you really do need a Macbeth in Macbeth, and we didn't have one here.
I think that's the consensus. Everything you said, I would say again that the space of the stage was used very, very well. The entire depth of the stage was used, but only for, you know, for effect and for scale. Not, it's not as if things were happening, you know, at the back of the stage a lot. If they had, then many people on the sides wouldn't have seen them, which used to be the rap against the Vivian Beaumont, as we discussed previously. The stage is very deep if you use all of it, and you can't necessarily see everything that happens back there, but you can see some of it even if you're on the sides, and it just creates this tremendous sense of scale. You know, it was almost like an opera the way.
Yes, right.
In some places, and Peter didn't mention, and I suppose this is a separate credit from Mr. Wiedemann, but I thought this the way that the scene of the witches. Predictions where the second time when they go to see them and they predict how, you know, the Macbeth goes to see them and they tell him about how, you know, he'll never be vanquished till Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane and et cetera, et cetera, and how he will not be killed by any one of woman born. The way that was done with really neat projections. And sound,
very neat, yes.
Sound effects. That was very, very effective. And as we've also mentioned when we discussed it before, you didn't comment specifically, Peter, but did you enjoy the way that the witches were used?
Sure. Yeah. The least feminine witches I've seen, you know? And for good reason.
They were men.
Yes, that's why. You know, so sure. And especially John Glover, I thought stood out tremendously well of the three of them.
So Peter, you got to see Handle with Care, which is a new show over at the West Side. So tell us what you think about it.
I'm afraid I didn't care for it at all. Didn't respond to the material in any way, shape, or form. This is a play about a woman who's Israeli, and she's traveling with her mother, who is played by Carol Lawrence, who I did not see. She was out the performance I attended. Geraldine Labrandi, an actress I've known for years and years and years. She was a Boston actress, and I used to see her quite a bit, played the part and played it extraordinarily well. I'm going to say that one of these women is not long for this world, and the play plays around with time going back and forth. So you see one of those two women alive, and then you go to the next day when she's not alive, and then you go back again when she is alive, and so on and so forth. One of the things that interested me was that it takes place in a motel room where there's a day-by-day calendar, like in 1776. So the day flips back from December 24th to December 23rd, back to December 24th, back to December 23rd. I don't know. I've stayed in a lot of motels. I've never seen one with a day-by-day calendar in it, you know. So I don't know why they didn't just put a projection on the back wall, you know, December 23rd, December 24th. mouth, you know, or we could have been fine with that. Two men are dealing with the death, and one of them has dealt with death before. His wife died tragically, and maybe he'll get involved with one of these two women. Perhaps he will, perhaps he won't. One of those plays. I wish I could say it was more interesting, more entertaining. I thought it was extraordinarily dry, with very little dialogue of interest, very little character development of interest, and I wish I could recommend it, but I can't remotely recommend it. To me, it was really one of the low points of the season.
So that's Handle with Care, and something else that probably needs to be handled with care is a new musical based on the life of Tupac Shakur coming to Broadway. Is that possible that we can handle that with care? So we saw that in the news this week. So what do you guys think about this? Peter?
All right, I'll go first. this is going to sound circumlocutionary, but years ago, I was talking to my young friend Joe Marchese, who may be young, but has the soul of an old Broadway enthusiast, loves Julie Stein, that type of thing. Well, anyway, Robert Goulet was about to go into La Cage aux Folles, and he was excited because he had never seen Robert Goulet. And somehow we started talking about Maltby and Shire. I don't remember why. And I said, you know, Maltby and Shire actually wrote a song that Robert Goulet sang. And he said, really? Yeah, what was that? And I said, it was from a movie called I'd Rather Be Rich. They wrote the title song, and he sang it over the credits. Oh, well, I got to find that song. And the next day I got an email from him, and he said, well, I typed in I'd Rather Be, figuring that would be enough. And what came up but a song by Tupac Shakur called I'd Rather Be Your Nigger. Well, I mean, good Lord. Now, I don't want anybody criticizing me for using the word because I am quoting the title. But yes. Is this going to be one of the songs that we're going to hear at the Palace Theater where Julie Garland and Gwen Verdon performed? I can't say that I'm particularly looking forward to this, if indeed that's the type where I don't know any Tupac Shakur songs, but I just know that title. And for me, it doesn't bode well for what's going to be happening this summer at the Palace.
Well, one of the things that most surprised me about it is the fact that it's going to be at the Palace. I mean, I guess I'm surprised that anyone would think that there would be that many people who would want to see a show like this, that would be the theater that you would put it in. So I may be wrong, but we'll see that. And also, you know, I mean, obviously when one discusses something like this, one runs the risk of seeming, what's the word, you know, not accepting of new types of music on Broadway. But to me, I have to say rap is in a separate category because there's no music. I mean, in a sense, there's really no music. And in fact, I reread the press release two or three times, and no one is credited with the music. Wow. It says the lyrics by Tupac Shakur.
I see.
And there is a credit for, I believe, music supervision and conducting, you know, something like that. But as it was explained to me when I discussed it with someone who knows more about that type of music than I do, which is basically nothing, which is what I know, they said that the music, quote unquote, is usually done by the producer. And it, you know, it's really just the beat and the whatever kind of tracks they use to go along with the lyrics. So I think this may be the first Broadway quote unquote musical to not have a music credit, and I don't know if that's a good thing. And also, see, to me, it's like, why would you give up something like the music in a musical? I mean, I thought that the rap sections of In the Heights and even Rent, you know, were very, very effective, but only because they're not the entire score. I cannot imagine sitting through an entire score where you don't have the music to give you all those extra colors and all those extra emotions. You know, it's almost like doing a sketch instead of a painting, although that's not really accurate. Yeah. You're giving up an entire, you know, I mean, I can't see how it could possibly maintain interest over an entire full length of a show. And in the same way that I don't think, I mean, I really might enjoy listening to a specific rap song, but I can't imagine going to a concert that would be entirely rap, because wouldn't it just become incredibly boring after a while? That's my musical theater, you know, I mean, musical theater. Oh, and by the way, I don't have the press release in front of me, but it said that this is not a bio musical. It's going to tell a story based on the songs of Tupac Shakur. I believe a fictional story, maybe with some basis in reality. So storytelling is what musical theater is about, and therefore it would seem to me that an entire score consisting entirely of rap is going to be a tremendously bad idea. So I guess we'll see.
So I'm on their website, hollerifyouhearme.com, and they have a little blurb that says, "The world inside Tupac Shakur's music and lyrics. Blazes to life in a non-biographical story about friendship, family, revenge, change, and hope. Inner city lives struggle for peace against the daily challenges they face in this entertaining original musical. Through the poetry of one of the 20th century's most influential and culturally prominent voices, we are given a window into the realities of the streets still relevant today." So it sounds like they have a story and they backfilled it with, you know, material.
I'm sorry if I misspoke, but I'm pretty positive because I read it over 3 times.
Yeah, sure.
Press release did not say anything about music.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think that they made probably made a mistake there because on the IBDB, it really just has one line. It says produced by Anif Shakur, Eric Gold, Jessica Green, Shinusu Shin, book by Todd Creedler, inspired by the music of Tupac Shakur, directed by Kenny Leon, choreographed by Wayne Cilento, scenic design, general manager, musical supervisor, Daryl Waters.
Yeah, the press release definitely said inspired by the lyrics of Tupac Shakur.
Yeah.
By the way, I didn't do the research. Do we know if that what is that first name that the producer credit?
The producer credit first one, Afeni Shakur. I mean,
no, I don't know if that's his
if it's related or
daughter. Yeah, well, presumably it's related. Yeah,
I'll tell you in a second. Afeni Shakur, Wikipedia, Born Alice Faye Williams, January 22nd, 1942, African-American music businesswoman, former political activist, ex-Black Panther. She's the mother of late rapper Tupac Shakur. Mom. Right. My mom never produced a Broadway show for me based on my work. I'm very upset about this.
Michael, maybe the press release didn't mention music because they're ashamed to call it music.
Well, I think that they were just being accurate. But it was explained to me. I mean, I don't know if this person, necessarily knows what he's talking about. But he said that the music, quote unquote, in rap is often done by the producer, and it's not always. And he said that but there's no music credit at all. And he said because if they were going to give a music credit, they would probably have to credit 50 different people.
Yeah.
So I said, "Oh, all right. Well, okay." But I was still aghast because I think I think it's safe to say that it's the first Broadway musical to not have a music credit.
So, Peter, did you have something else to say? I was going to move on to something else.
Well, I was thinking, you know, in a way, this reminds me of another show that opened in June many moons ago, and that was Got to Go Disco. Mm. And that was certainly during the disco craze, and it didn't do well at all.
I remember.
At all. And, maybe just being trendy isn't enough, and they certainly suffered. I will tell you that Gotta Go Disco... was so chaotic. They kept on postponing their opening and what have you. So one night I just dropped into the Minskoff with a couple of friends figuring, you know, let's see what they're doing. So we walked in and I'm telling you, they were fighting like crazy. We finally decided, well, you know, nothing's happening. We better leave. Well, you know, when you come down the escalators of the Minskoff, you see, after a while, when they're closing up the theater, they have grates, you know, so we couldn't get out. Now I
don't understand, Peter. You went in during a rehearsal?
Yeah, we just walked in. Walked in up the escalators, walked into the theater, and I still remember hearing the first thing we ever heard from the stage was "Akin disaster." You know, we walked in, we missed the F, but know, and I still remember the director, whoever the director du jour was, saying, "Justin, drop your attitude." You know, so it was that type of rehearsal. So then, as I say, we come down the escalators. There are those grates. We can't get out. Now, I'd already been to Gypsy run-throughs of Timbuktu and the Prince of Grand Street on the stage of the Minskoff. So I knew where the stage door was. And I said to my two friends, "Look, do not worry. We are going to walk on that stage. We're going to walk back to where the stage door exit is, and nobody's going to bother us because nobody has any idea what's going on in this show, and they're going to assume we're connected with the show. Now just follow me," and that's exactly what we did. We just walked on stage. Nobody said, "Who are you?" Nobody questioned anything, and we went back to the stage door and came down, and that was that. So
that's hilarious.
The true story. I will take a polygraph test anytime anybody wants to challenge me on that. Yeah.
No, Peter, you'd be a rapper. You're a bad boy yourself.
Yes, that's right. I have the soul of a rapper. That's the worst thing you've ever said to me, James. Don't let that happen again.
Well, excuse me, in order to cleanse our palate of Tupac the musical, Mr. Riedel brings us the notice that Hee Haw is bound for Broadway. Have we really stripped the gears here and gone from one to the other? Is it April 1st?
It has to happen. You know, I mean, really, the new generation of people who come in who are now old enough to buy theater tickets, you know, affluent enough to buy theater tickets, grew up in an era where there was Tupac Shakur and Hee Haw. So, this is what's going to happen more and more and more. I mean, and we either go to see these shows or we don't, you know, but this is what we're going to be offered. So,
And I'm wondering, James, if, you know, in 20, 25 years, either of these shows will be a question on Jeopardy.
Tell us about that, Michael.
Well, they had an online test for Jeopardy this past week, and I took it apparently with a lot of other people. I mean, a lot of other people that I know. For some reason, this one seemed to, I think they publicized this one quite a bit on the show. And I don't know how well I did, because I know that it's said that the online test is much more difficult than the actual answers or questions or answers, I should say, on the show. There was one question about this 60s Broadway musical was based on stories by Shalom Aleichem, so I think I got that one. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I got any others. We'll see. Oh, but here's a funny story. on the show also this week, one of the titles was Complete the Broadway Title. And I thought, oh, wow, I wish I was on. I'm going to ace this. And in fact, I knew, you know, every one of them until I think one of them was a double Jeopardy question. And I said, oh, if that was me, I would, you know, I would bet everything.
The farm, yeah.
And then the answer was a Bengal tiger at the blank zoo. And I could not remember that word.
Isn't that funny?
So I would have lost it all.
I would have said, who is Robin Williams?
Exactly. That I remembered. I remembered he was in it. I just could not remember that word.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So
game shows. I often think, you know, Family Feud. How many families have been so divided by Family Feud that for years to come, people say to Uncle Herman, "You said X when you should have said Y, you damn fool. You cost us $1 million." You know, I mean, there must be so many hard feelings among families as a result of having Family Feud. There must be. There has to be. The person who came up with the stupid answer. It has to be.
Families, we seem to find any reason to fight, don't we?
Certainly in mine, but that's another story.
Hey, the National Theater's production of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is coming into in New York. This was gained a special notoriety back in December because the ceiling of the theater fell during a performance, causing some injuries to the playgoers.
Frankly, I'm amazed this hasn't happened more often. I mean, these playhouses are very old buildings, you know, and I think we really have to give some credit to the people who maintain them, because so many times I think, gee, you know, 100 years old these buildings are, and yet they look good. They seem safe. You never hear of anything happening. This was the first time that I had ever heard of anything like this happening in my lifetime. And, yeah, we have to look at the fact that the other theaters have not had experiences like this. So kudos to the people who maintain these theaters and who built them, of course, you know, and obviously did a good job. So, but, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the play. Supposedly it's terrific.
A friend of mine who saw it said it was one of the best plays he's seen in many, many years. So thought, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't really done much research on the play itself. And obviously it was in the news for that unfortunate reason that had nothing to do with the play itself. But apparently, according to this friend, it's really quite something.
Back in the 90s, late 90s, I was doing a developmental production of Neil Berg's version of The Prince and the Pauper, and we were doing it up at the Irvington Town Hall Theater up in Irvington, New York, which is a cute, a beautiful little theater, and we were really well sold, so well sold that we had one seat empty, and it was in the in kind of their mezzanine balcony area. And in the middle of the show, a piece of plaster fell from the ceiling and landed in that one empty
seat. Wow.
That's incredible.
Wow. And
we were it was unbelievable.
Yeah, of course.
It was just unbelievable because it was one of those things. It was a good producing lesson for me because we did not take out extra insurance on the production because it was a small little production. The budget was like $50,000 or something small. And I didn't take insurance. And I thought to myself, I would have lost everything financially if that had hit somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just unbelievable. But
if you were doing Macbeth, maybe somebody would have been sitting in that seat.
Sure.
Yes, but if we had asked my stage manager would have forgotten it. So before we wrap up, we wanted to talk about a few Masterworks Broadway recordings that have been brought in in the new year. We have Little Abner being released on January 14th, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf being released on February 18th, and A Brigadoon Kiss Me Kate television soundtracks are going to be released on March 18th. And Michael and Peter, I'm assuming you both have listened to these.
No, all I've had so far is Little Abner, and this is the soundtrack from the 1959 movie. So, of course, a soundtrack being, well, let's put it this way, in the 50s, musical movies were played with a bit, you know, in the sense that many songs were dropped. So, Oh Happy Day, Progress is the Root of All Evil, Love in a Home, and What's Good for General Bill Moose are not on this recording. However, there is that song Otherwise, which I think is an improvement on the original Love in a Home, because Love in a Home involved a tender and valid enough sentiment, but Otherwise deals with a genuine conflict. You know, Daisy May is nobly marrying a man she doesn't want in order to keep Abner out of harm's way, and now the reality of their never becoming man and wife is dawning on both of them. And I mean, that's really a much more poignant song. Of course, being a Hollywood musical, you have many more instruments in the orchestra, so you have that big lush sound. But it's the Lavender Light because you don't get as many songs, but still it's a terrific recording. And it's not quite a soundtrack recording because some of these were actually played within the studio. It's not. So if you've seen the movie, which is prized by many of us because it's a movie that really replicates the Broadway show as much as the Pajama Game and Damn Yankees do. So you get most of the original cast, not all, but most. And it's done mostly on a soundstage, so it really looks like a filmed Broadway show. That bothers a lot of people, of course. You know, oh, they didn't open it up and all that kind of business. And it does look stage-like and artificial in that way. But for those of us who want to know what shows look like in the 50s, this is a very good example of one. So so the soundtrack is a lot of fun, and I enjoyed listening to it immeasurably.
Peter, What's Good for General Bulmus isn't on the album, but it is in the movie, or at least, I mean, I don't...
I'm only talking about the soundtrack album.
I've been clamoring for this album for years. In fact, I suggested to Bruce Kimmel that he do a re-release of it. And I may have even said that when he was on the podcast. But I'm so happy because aside from everything else, the sound quality of it is extraordinary. And as Peter said, really all of the leads, I think, except for two of the female leads,
right.
We have Leslie Parrish, who was an up and coming actress at the time and does not do her own singing. She's the only person in it who does not, I believe. And then also, for whatever reason, Billy Hayes replaced Charlotte Ray. And I think Billy Hayes maybe replaced her on Broadway or done it in stock, but I think she played the role on stage somewhere before she played Mammy Yoakum in the movie.
Edie Adams was the original on stage for Daisy May. The thing is, both those ladies were pregnant when the movie was happening.
Oh, that's right. In fact, Edie Adams told me that directly, and that she said that they were going to wait for her, but then they decided they couldn't. She was a really big star at the time.
Mm-hmm.
As we've mentioned, Valerie Harper and Beth Howland are both in the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a great album, and it is odd because some of the songs on the soundtrack album sound to me like one or two of them maybe sound like they're exactly what's as heard in the movie, but many of them mm-hmm. it sound like different takes, and some of them sound. Even the arrangements are quite different.
The arrangements are different. One of the things that they wanted to do at the time, because show music was still being played on the radio, was mm-hmm. give a chance to make more
radio play
popular music-y type cuts. So If I Have My Druthers, for example, is much longer on the soundtrack album than it is on the film. But it's a very nice album. This is a very good score by Gene DePaul and Johnny Mercer, and it's certainly well worth hearing.
And but we should say the arrangements are Nelson Riddle, who.
Some of them are, you know, he was terrific. You know, the work he did with Sinatra was amazing, and he did very good work here too.
One thing I'll be curious to see is, as I said, the sound quality of it is phenomenal. I have a transfer of the LP that I treasure, but I am interested to see if they do anything about it. It is a little aggressive, the soundtrack album. Album in the voices coming from the far left and the far right, and sometimes it's maybe a little too much. So I wonder if they're going to if they have the original elements and they can maybe ameliorate that a bit. I know Bruce Kimmel made a point of that with which was the book?
Promises, Sugar.
One of the ones he did. It's a matter of taste, of course.
Again, stereo was new at that time, but everybody was playing around with it. It reminds me of when my father got a home movie camera that could zoom in. Good Lord, every shot was a zoom. You know, so same type of thing. You know, I mean, they were just so excited to the stereo was happening. And don't forget, the original Little Abner was not recorded in stereo.
Just missed it.
Indeed. Indeed, yes. Right. Bells Are Ringing, which opened a week later, was the first one to be recorded in stereo. So so therefore, they were playing around with this. They were having a good time, little kids with their new toy, you know. So that's why there is aggressive, as you say, stereo. So so that's the reason.
All right. So let's wrap it up for the week. Anything else you got to throw in before we go?
I don't think so.
Michael?
No, just that those other albums briefly that they're coming out with also are of great interest. The two television recordings, again, not soundtracks.
Yeah.
Separate studio recordings of the musicals. Now, which two is it? With the
Brigadoon and Kiss Me, Kate?
Yes, both with Robert Goulet, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Brigadoon, I have a dub of the actual video, and it's Sally Ann Howes in the lead, and but I have never heard the album of that, and I've never seen or heard Kiss Me, Kate. So, which is Carol Lawrence, right?
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm not saying no, but
I think it's. Yes, I think it's playing Carol Lawrence, whom we mentioned earlier in the podcast, but also who was married to Mr. Goulet at the time, and apparently it seems like maybe that their offstage relationship was not dissimilar to what we have in Kiss Me, Kate. So, and then the other one is it's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Yes.
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 Which many people swear by this recording. I recently heard someone say that recording to them ruined the movie for them because the recording of the original cast, the Broadway cast, is so great. There was a time when a great many of those were done, either original casts or just amazing casts of actors for spoken word recordings of plays that were done in the studio. And for anyone who's interested, there's quite an amazing catalog of those if you look them up. And it's it's such good news that some of them are coming out now. And I think that's a great one to start with. I think that's the first one in this series, isn't it, Peter?
Mm-hmm.
The first non-musical, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's really, I think that's excellent news.
Last week, during our interview with Tom Wopat, we noted a few times that there was a lot of emergency vehicles going by Michael's window there. And unfortunately, it turned out that it was a very serious fire over on 9th Avenue. Or is it 10th Avenue? 9th Avenue?
10th,
and
10th.
10th Avenue. And somebody had died in that fire. We didn't mean to make light of that. It was just that it was unusual to hear so many fire trucks happening at Michael's on Michael's side. So anyway, we wanted to just acknowledge that did happen.
Yes, it's terrible that it turned out to be something really, really tragic and resulted in the loss of life of an aspiring playwright. And at least two of our other friends live in that same building, Jim Brochu and Steve Shalkin.
Yeah.
But they're fine. I'm happy to
hear.
Yes, yes. So, that was pretty awful.
All right, so let's wrap it up for the week. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There'll be a subscribe button that way. Each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you can also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream This Week on Broadway to you directly. Broadway World Radio also plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. I know that everybody's going to want to run over and get over to the Tupac Shakur website, HollerIfYouCanHearMe.com. So, on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
If I had my druthers, I'd rather have my druthers than do any work at all.